First case is 08-AP-1144, Orrick Cranberry Marsh v. Jackson County. Arguing on behalf of Jackson County is Mark Hazelbecker. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. It's an honor to be here today. Occam's razor is an ancient rule of logic that tells us when we are confronted by two propositions that we should choose the simpler of the two. It is our position that in this case, when reading the deed at issue in this matter, the Court of Appeals unfortunately decided to take the other approach, to choose the more complex and strained interpretation of this 1978 deed. Had the Court of Appeals simply read the plain language of the deed and stopped, they would have reached the conclusion that there was a specific and obvious intent when this deed was drafted to convey flowage rights for water, but not to make the sand rights hereditable and assignable. We can find that from the plain language of the deed and need not go further as the Court of Appeals did.
Counselor, how long was it after 1978 when this easement was granted that the county decided the rights were just for the initial grantee?
It's not in the record, Justice Rogensack, but I can tell you that the dispute arose in the middle part of the last decade because this action was commenced in 2007 after the Borex had approached the county to begin removing sand, and the county had refused to do it. Okay. So inferentially, it would have been at least almost 30 years after, on the order of 30 years after the deed was granted.
Okay, thank you.
But it's not in the record, just to be clear. The deed itself has, in its language, as I'm sure you're well familiar from reading the briefs, two different grants. Now, one says that it grants to Carl Nemitz his heirs and assigns flowage rights. And then, significantly, in the follow-up paragraph, the deed states, this easement shall be perpetual, providing that the flowage rights hereby granted are being used for the purpose of cranberry culture. The fact that this reference to this easement is perpetual refers to the flowage rights is unmistakable, because the paragraph says, this easement shall be perpetual, providing that the flowage rights hereby granted are being used for the purposes of cranberry culture. If it had been intended that the easement rights granted to be perpetual were also sand rights, that would have been put in paragraph 2. And of course, the final leg of this three-legged stool is that final paragraph, or the final grant, which says, the grantor does hereby grant and convey to the grantee the further right and privilege to remove sand from the above described lands to be used for the purpose of cranberry culture upon the grantee's adjacent lands. Now, of course, it's beyond dispute that the statutes say that when you make a conveyance, when you write a deed, it includes heirs and assigns. But that rule is not unqualified. The statute, section 706.10, subparagraph 3, states, and I quote, in conveyances of lands, words of inheritance shall not be necessary to create or convey a fee, and every conveyance shall pass all the estate or interest of the grantee unless a different intent shall appear expressly or by necessary implication in the terms of such conveyance. Well, that's the leg upon which the Borex rely, that by inference, using the statutory language, we must, in their opinion, read in heirs and assigns to the conveyance of sand rights. The problem with that is this. If you do that, you wind up with the first conveyance, meaning convey to Carl Nemitz his heirs and assigns, and by operation of law, his heirs and assigns. In other words, they granted the right to heirs and assigns twice, once by express words and once by the implication of statute. The second paragraph, they argue, must be read to make that grant of sand rights assignable and hereditable because statutory language requires it. But again, that statutory requirement isn't absolute. It is limited by situations in which the grant is expressly limited or in which a necessary implication otherwise arises. Both are present here. First of all, the deed expressly limits the first conveyance to be the one and only hereditable and assignable conveyance. It does that because the drafter used terms of inheritance expressly.
When you keep referring to the deed, you're referring to the easement for flowage rights?
Yes, ma'am. The one that is document 216153.
And it's 216153. I've got that. That's dated after the deed to the Borex.
It's a correction deed.
It's a correction deed. Where's the original?
1977.
Easement? Where is that?
It's in the record.
The appendix?
It's in the appendix, ma'am.
Pardon me?
I think it's in the one of the appendices.
Okay, I'll look for that.
So
this really isn't an easement to Nemitz because he is no longer owning the property.
The original easement was to Nemitz.
Right.
And he then assigned his easement rights to
the Borex. He didn't assign it, he deeded it.
He conveyed them, I shouldn't say he assigned them, he conveyed
further conveyed to the grantees, the heirs and assigns, all of their rights, meaning I suppose the grantor's rights,
mm-hmm.
in and to an easement executed in favor of them by Jackson County concerning flowage rights and singing rights. Concerning, and then there's a, it looks to me, northwest quarter, that's a correct
description
of the land. Okay.
Of course, the fact that Mr. Nemitz subsequently conveyed his rights to Mr. Borek and their heirs and assigns doesn't prove what the original deed meant. I mean, I can quit claim my rights to the Brooklyn Bridge, but if I don't own the Brooklyn Bridge, that quit claim...
This wasn't a quit claim, it was a warranty.
I understand that, but he can't, even with a warranty of title, he can't convey what he doesn't
own. But it may show his intent. Because he's one of the original parties here.
And the point is, it may show his intent, but it doesn't show Jackson County's intent, because Jackson County didn't join in that subsequent deed.
Well, how did the trial court figure out the intent of the parties?
The trial court didn't. I don't think the trial court tried to figure out the intent of the parties. I think the trial court simply relied on the language of the deed and found that the fact that different wording was used indicated a different meaning.
Wasn't that the trial court's attempt at the intent of the parties? That is, what do the words say? What did the parties intend with these words?
Exactly.
Yeah, we didn't have any parole evidence, but it was just what do the words say, and how do they reflect? In what way do they reflect the intent of the parties?
Exactly. And it's our position, and it's an important point with broader implications than just this case, that you have to confine the analysis to the words of the deeds unless it's absolutely impossible to go beyond them. Because to do otherwise poses risks of creating uncertainty in conveyances, will intimidate people and make them reluctant to grant easements and enter into transactions for fear that they may later be broadened in judicial construction. And frankly, it runs the risk of making people reluctant to do deals at all. Where the Court of Appeals, I think, went wrong is in paragraph 13 of their opinion, where they state, and this is, I think, the key question, I'm quoting, the drafter may have included the, quote, or single quote, heirs and assigns and single quote language in the first paragraph merely out of habit or tradition. Regardless, it is reasonable to interpret the deed in a way that does not attach great significance to the selective use of an archaic phrase that itself no longer carries meaning in the law. Well, there's no factual basis in this record upon which the Court of Appeals could have made any conclusion at all about what tradition was in drafting deeds, or about what is or is not archaic, or what the drafter intended at all. The drafter is, by the way, now a circuit judge, but in any event, there's no legislative history, as it were, to tell us what the parties intended here. All you can look at, as is the case in many of these circumstances, is what the language says, what the parties did, not what they intended. We have to presume intent from words. If we don't, we're going to find ourselves in a host of problems. Now, there's also the the problem that merely because the words heirs and assigns are, to use the Court of Appeals phrase, archaic, doesn't mean that we shouldn't find that they are purposeless. They mean something today that, as they always have. Heirs means the people that are entitled to receive your property at the time of death. Assigns means people to whom you have transferred your interest in something. What's archaic, perhaps, is the necessity of overdrafting deeds, which was addressed by the curative statute, section 706.10 sub 3. That statute, however, doesn't mean that retroactively we can go back and read into deeds meanings that weren't intended to be there. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that this deed was drafted before the statute. It wasn't. What I'm saying, though, is that the statute doesn't give us an unlimited license to rewrite ancient deeds. It simply says that there's a presumption that it means heirs and assigns, but that presumption can be overridden by either express language or necessary implication, both of which are present here.
Does this cranberry marsh need both water and sand to operate?
Again, Madam Chief Justice, the facts, just to address the factual base, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Just to address the factual posture as to that point, in the trial court, we offered some, when we moved for summary judgment, we offered some supplemental facts about cranberry culture, facts that I might add I gained from a trip that I went on with Mr. Arndt to the cranberry marsh, and I learned an awful lot about cranberry culture that day. I don't think those facts are seriously disputed, but in the subsequent briefing, Mr. Arndt commented that they weren't technically part of the summary judgment record. I think it is...
Are they or are they not part of the summary judgment record?
I would maintain that they are because they were not opposed in the summary judgment proceedings in the trial court. And I think it's a basic fact that cranberry cultivation needs a lot of water and a lot of sand.
Well, then, what business was Niemitz in?
Cranberry cultivation.
All right. So if he needs both to operate it, wouldn't you think he would want it in perpetuity, or at least rather than just have half of a loaf, mixing metaphors?
It's a good question. And the answer is what the parties wound up agreeing to, not what they would like to get out of the deal. When I buy a new car, I might later like to have gotten an extended warranty out of it, but if I didn't buy it originally, I don't get it.
What's the rule about getting evidence as to the party's intent when the language leaves open what it means to the reader? I mean, both of you have really very good arguments as to what this language means.
This is
right?
The interpretation of a
you
deed.
You agree with that? I mean, they're both possible and plausible. I would
argue that they're both possible. I would argue only my theory is plausible.
But,
okay. I mean, I wouldn't be much.
That's not a very strong concession. So
it made a big difference to Judge Posner in an argument I had a couple of years ago. But in any event, the point about the difference between water and sand is that there may have been a need for sand. The question is not whether there's a need for sand in cranberry cultivation ad infinitum. The question is whether the agreement was to give him sand ad infinitum.
Is sand running out? Is that in the record? Is that what Jackson County's problem is?
I don't think that that fact isn't in the record. I think it's a matter of common knowledge that there is a limit to how much earth you can remove from any piece of land, whereas water is a self-renewing resource. We get rain. The water flows, and it's a renewing resource. There's a very good reason why Jackson County may have bargained with Mr. Nemitz to give him the right to remove sand personally so that he could start his cranberry bog and keep it going for a while, but not allow it to go on for 30, 40, 50, 100 years.
What is the limit?
I'm sorry, what is
what is the limit?
The limit
the
would
easement.
Be, the limit, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Judge.
No, that's all right, I'm done.
The limit of how much use of sand would be during Mr. Nemitz's ownership. Now, again, we don't have the facts of this transaction in the record. We don't know anything. We don't know whether Mr. Nemitz may have just been starting this bog in order to sell it. The fact is, that's what he did.
What was the original? That's why I asked you. the easement here is, the easement that you say is a correction easement is dated after Nemeth sold the property. The warranty deed from Nemeth to Borak, right, is dated May 8th. It was received in the Register of Deeds May 8th. Now, is that 1979? No, 78.
Right.
The easement is dated May 13th, and it was, well, I'll tell you, boy, this is a mess. Dated and notarized May 12th, but if it says received in the Register of Deeds May 10th, how can you receive it before it's dated?
I guess but I can only
regardless of that, it's regardless, whichever date you want to know, it's after May 8th. So I want to know what is the date, which is a matter of open public record, of the original easement to Nemeth.
I'm going to have to check my brief.
Sorry, maybe I just missed it in your brief, and I should have remembered it. You know, this is interesting, too. It says the easement is given for the purpose of correcting an erroneous description in volume 226 of records, page 751, and this is 233. So it's seven volumes later, but I have no idea what the...
I'm not able to come up with that.
Okay.
My statement of facts indicates the original deed was in 1977. I can only tell you that
the original deed to the original easement to Nemeth was 1977. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And there's certainly never been a controversy between the parties about the timing of the easement rights and the timing of the conveyance.
Is it your position that that easement was personal to the Nemeths, and
yes,
when they sold it, it was gone?
That's correct.
Okay. So it was a one-year easement as a result of this. Now, suppose the Nemeths had kept this property. How long would it be?
It would have been as long as Mr. Nemeth held it. In other words, it wasn't necessarily a one-year easement. It just proved to be a one-year easement. We don't know what was going on here. There are any number of ways we could speculate, but then that's one of Mr. Arndt's arguments, that Mr. Nemeth could have made as extensive use of that as the Boricks could today, but he didn't. Okay, that isn't the point in any event. Whatever the case may be, whatever extent of use Mr. Nemeth may have made of the sand rights, he might have, if he survived, used it for a very long period of time. But at some point, the fact that the easement's language can only be interpreted as indicating that the easement rights are personal to Mr. Nemeth, not hereditable. At some point, that would terminate them. I'd like to take a few seconds to talk about why I think this issue is very significant. In my practice, I do a lot of real estate work. And when people come to me with questions, sometimes people will ask me, you know, can you do me a driveway easement? Or can you do an encroachment easement to allow somebody to maintain a garage that was built a little bit too close to the setback line? In order to avoid having to tear the garage down? Or can we do a footpath easement or something like that? Every single time that people talk about doing easements like this for neighborly purposes, I always get the question, if I agree to this and make an easement with this understanding, am I going to regret it later? Is somebody going to come along later and twist it and try to make it something that it isn't? And I've also had cases where people have, in fact, done that, where people have taken joint driveway easements, which weren't necessarily drafted all that well originally, and stretched them and tried to turn them into parking school buses or have acted.
You give a license if you're concerned about the easement going further than you want and not worry about having any of those problems.
Well, in fact, granting a license or even granting a long-term lease is certainly another tool that's out there. There's a toolkit of the bundle of rights that's available. P- people tend to request easements because their lenders tend to want easements to support ongoing value of a property. My point is this, that there's only one rational way to, and however you decide the ultimate result in this case, there's only one rational way for the courts to allocate the responsibility for crafting a conveyance, and that is to the parties and their drafters. If we don't do that, then we run the risk of creating so much uncertainty as to the scope of what will happen to these transactions years down the road that people are going to stop doing them. You have another case, you have other cases that are coming up before you tomorrow for argument involving this very issue. If people think that the courts are going to allow people to bootstrap a hunting rights easement into a much broader hunting rights easement, they're going to stop granting hunting rights easements. People are going to stop granting encroachment easements. Easements are an economically efficient way for people to allocate rights in land.
Maybe they'll draft it more carefully.
That's my point. That's exactly my point. The burden has to be on the drafters to say exactly what they mean. They did that in this 1978.
That's the issue we're faced with. Didn't
That's
they?
Correct. But I think that the my response to that, Chief Justice Abramson, is that to argue that they didn't is to argue that the drafter of this deed, as the Court of Appeals said, simply slipped in a couple of stray words. And I don't think that's fair. First of all, although I don't know the drafter personally, I don't think we should presume or even assume that someone did something inadvertently. There's no facts, and there are no facts in the record to base that.
All the drafter says, it used to be that the drafter's name was at the bottom. I guess they must have eliminated that.
It is on the bottom, but it's not on this
it's
page.
It's on your page. Okay.
It was the Circuit Judge Lobbs from Jackson County, okay. Which is why it was assigned out, wasn't it? Yeah. In any event.
The point is that the drafter could have just said, it doesn't run with the land. Or, those are nice terms that people understand generally, or they could have said, this conveyance to remove sand is limited to this grantee.
I think he said that, but he said that in his way. I think if you look at the paragraph that says that this easement shall be perpetual, I think the term this easement refers to the first paragraph because that says, in the first paragraph says, an easement for flowage. The third paragraph says that the grantor grants and conveys to the grantee the right and privilege. Didn't use the word easement.
Here,
I think that you could put
thing
together.
That raised me my concern is it says that this easement, which is a reference back to paragraph one, shall be perpetual, providing that the flowage rights hereby granted. So this easement is general. Flowage rights is, you would say, limited to the prior paragraph. Are hereby granted, are being used for the purpose of cranberry culture. So this is a recognition of cranberry culture. That's why I asked you, was sand important for cranberries?
And it is. There's no question that it is.
Yeah.
But the question is,
right.
Is Jackson County willing to give a perpetual quarry right to its neighboring property for perpetual?
Well, suppose that there's just no more sand, or that the sand is such that you're going to just totally ruin the land and there'll be erosion and what have you. Can't Jackson County come in and get this easement changed?
They could negotiate with
what about
the
a court? I mean, impossibility is always in contracts a possible out.
I suppose that if you looked at it that way, Jackson County could attempt to buy out the easement rights. But sand in this context would be expensive, and the right is very valuable. That's why we reached this level.
Council, what was the total consideration paid for the water flowage rights and the sand removal?
$500.
Is there anything in the record to indicate its adequacy or inadequacy?
There is not. $500 was, I will say, that was a substantial amount of money in 1978. It's not a tiny amount of money today. The nice thing about, but look, if you want to look at consideration, though, water rights are cheap to convey because to a certain extent in wet areas like this part of Jackson County, moving water onward is actually a benefit. So I don't think you can really, frankly, infer either way anything from the dollar amount because there's no facts. I think you have to go back to the language. In closing, and my time is almost up, I do want to say that this case reflects important principles that this court has had to struggle with before. There have been cases where you've confronted decisions about certainty and about drafting. Please give us some guidance that makes the burden of clarity and honors the clarity of drafters. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Daniel C. Arndt, representing Borat Cranberry Marsh, Inc.
Chief Justice Stevenson, may I please the court?
So you can raise the podium if it would be. Now, I don't remember where the you found it, but is that better for you?
That's fine if you can hear me okay.
I think that will
Thank
be better
you.
For us.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Arndt. I represent Borat Cranberry Marsh. We wish to thank you for your attention and for the courtesies extended in this case. Both sides seem to agree that the language in this easement is not ambiguous. In fact, our position is that the analysis of this case begins with the legislative direction provided within Wisconsin Statute 706.10 sub 3 and ends there, along with the language of the easement itself. The statutory direction, as we've just covered, provides a general rule which states, in conveyances of land, words of inheritance shall not be necessary to create or convey a fee, and every conveyance shall pass all the estate or interest of the grantor. That is the general rule. That is where we start. The statute then contains an exception, which has two possible triggering mechanisms. The first trigger is, unless a different intent shall appear expressly. The county argues in its brief that there is an express reservation. I think it is clear that there is not an express reservation. The county's reliance really has to be on the second trigger, the necessary implication test. But let's talk about the express intent, or the express reservation. The easement, in fact, does contain four express reservations. Two, in fact, are contained within paragraph 4, which is the sand removal rights. So this drafter clearly knew how to write an express reservation and clearly could have achieved the goal of expressly reserving the transferability of these sand rights without taking the circuitous route which the county argues they took. The other two reservations, one is in the third paragraph, which the Chief Justice read concerning this easement is perpetual unless the flowage rights must be used for cranberry culture. And the final reservation is in the final paragraph where the drafter reserves the right for the public to access the property for hunting and fishing rights. It is instructive and important to note that the drafter of the easement clearly knew the importance of express reservations, clearly knew how to put an express reservation into the easement, and most importantly, clearly did not put an express reservation in the easement to prohibit the transferability of the sand removal rights. The county has to argue that the drafter intended to restrict the transferability of the sand rights in paragraph 4, not by putting language in paragraph 4, as the drafter did with the other two reservations that he expressly put in paragraph 4, but rather intentionally elected to put words, which by everyone's agreement are superfluous, into the second paragraph in order to affect by implication the intent of the fourth paragraph.
Counsel, it seems to me that your opposing counsel is focusing not just on the words his heirs and assigns, but in addition, other words. And I want to ask you about those other words. It's the document begins with the title, Easement for Flowage Rights. And then in relevant part, it indicates
It conveys to Carl Nimitz his heirs and assigns, we already dealt with that, an easement for flowage with full rights and privileges. So the easement, what easement are we talking about? What does an easement refer to?
Well, in our view, Your Honor, that's clear under the language of the easement itself, because it's an easement for flowage rights. The first paragraph, I think it is instructive to look at the first paragraph, says this easement, the entire easement. And it's instructive to note that in that paragraph, it states to the grantee. It does not say to heirs and assigns.
Well, let me start then right where you were, and with the first word in the very first paragraph, this easement. Excuse me. And you folk, that's one of the things that makes this job so enjoyable. I like focusing on these words. You're suggesting that this easement, that the this means everything below it. And as I read it, the this would likely refer to the words immediately preceding it. Easement for flowage rights. This easement, which easement? Easement for flowage rights, right?
I agree with you.
Okay. Then we get to the language that deals with, and this paragraph right after the description, it says that this easement. Now, what easement are they talking about there? This easement.
I think.
Shall be perpetual. That's what I'm reading from. That this easement, what does that refer to? What does this refer to?
That, again, I believe refers to the entire document, this easement.
And not back up to the easement for flowage rights. Mm-hmm.
It contains that. That's all part of this
easement.
And that's
one of the differences. Yeah. When the paragraph to Carl Nimitz, his heirs and assigns, and easement, it's referring to everything kind of below and not necessarily what preceded it, because what preceded it is easement for flowage rights. That's your interpretation. Is that correct?
If you're referring to the second paragraph now.
To Carl Nimitz, his heirs and assigns, right. And easement.
I believe that in that paragraph, and easement is referring to that paragraph. Because there's clearly two grants within the easement. There's the flowage grant, there's a sand removal grant, which are inextricably tied together. I think that's an important point. There should be no mistake as to what flowage rights are, but in order so that a mistake doesn't affect the analysis of this, I want to just touch base on that briefly. Because
Before you do that, and I don't want to cut you off, but I just want to just ask my final question, and then you can go
certainly.
And do whatever you want. And that is, the paragraph that says that this easement shall be perpetual, providing that the flowage rights hereby granted are being used, etc. The shall be perpetual appears with regard to the flowage rights, but that phrase is not repeated with regard to the conveyance of rights for sand. What, if any, import is it that shall be perpetual provides for flowage rights and does not appear in the paragraph regarding sand rights?
I believe this is, I agree with you, this is one of the fun parts of this business. If we go back to our grammatical school or grammar school sentence dissection lessons way back when, and do that dissection to this paragraph, the subject of this paragraph is that this easement is the subject, shall be perpetual, okay? So this easement shall be perpetual. Now, here comes the restriction to this easement, the entire easement being perpetual, providing that the flowage rights hereby granted are being used for the purpose of cranberry culture. So that doesn't say the flowage rights easement shall be perpetual. It says the entire easement shall be perpetual, and there's a restriction in there. Similarly, there's a restriction in the grant of the sand rights saying that those rights shall be used for cranberry culture on the adjacent land as an additional restriction. Now, the flowage, going back to the issue on the flowage rights, a couple of times in the Court of Appeals brief and perhaps in the Supreme Court brief, and I'm sure it was unintentional, there was language that would suggest that the flowage rights means taking the water off the servient estate. That is not what flowage rights are. Flowage rights mean exactly the opposite. Flowage rights mean the right to overflow the servient estate with water. That similar to what we have in ancient dam cases, and the language of the easement itself makes that clear. It states the right and privilege to flow with water. The reason that's important is that demonstrates the intricate relationship between removing sand and overflowing the property with water. Given the fact that water is a fluid substance, you have to have a basin to hold the water on the servient estate.
Counselor, I had a question when I read this, and it may not be in the record, or maybe you won't know it, but they fill the cranberry bogs with water as part of the harvesting process, and then apparently drain it off, and that's what they need the flowing rights for.
Exactly.
When they drain the water off, doesn't some of the sand that they've been putting on there go back onto the county's land again?
Well,
I mean, I just kind of wondered if this isn't just a big cycle that's going on anyway, and the sand they're trying to get is sand, at least in part, that was already on the bogs.
I don't know the answer to that, other than to say that I presume a part of it would be come back, but I'm sure most of it would not because of the nature of this. The water actually spends most of the time in the reservoir, mm-hmm. Thus needing the flowage rights,
right.
And less time in the bogs. The bogs, as you probably know, are the water can come in there by intricate gates and canals and ditches.
Yeah.
So I would, again, I don't know, but I would think most of the sand would, it's not a rush of water where most of the sand would get back out of there.
Okay. Well, it seems to me if they don't get some of the sand out with the flowage rights, eventually the bogs are going to be a mountain rather than a bog.
That's a good logical interpretation.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, I'm sorry to take your time. When I'm reading all these briefs, it just kept sticking in my mind, so I had to ask you. Sorry.
Right. This is an interesting case in
that
the
is.
Sense that there are some facts that aren't in the record because it was a summary judgment. And,
right.
But a lot of the facts are not disputed. So.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Counsel, how do you think the Frody versus Long case enters into our decision in this matter?
I think Frody versus Long does not enter into for four reasons, Your Honor. The first is that Frody versus Long is a rule of interpretation, and we do not...
Just remind everybody what that is, about how you interpret it against for the county.
Right. Right. This is a presumption in favor of the government, a governmental unit.
Okay.
Okay. The reason that it does not enter in is there's four reasons. First of all, everyone seems to agree the deed is not ambiguous. Unlike 706.10, which applies whether the deed is ambiguous or not, 706.10 is a statutory rule of construction that attaches even if the deed is unambiguous. However, we do not get to Frody versus Long unless the deed is ambiguous. And everyone seems to agree that it is not.
How can we be fighting about it if it's not ambiguous? I know the court says it's not ambiguous unless reasonable people can differ, and then ignores everybody who's differs as being unreasonable. I mean, how can you say it's not ambiguous? We're spending 40 minutes now trying to leaf through these words.
I think that's a very good question, and on its face would be the answer would be it has to be ambiguous. But the reason I think that both parties are arguing it's unambiguous is both parties feel that it can be interpreted within the four corners of the document, that the words are there, and if you simply read the words, it means what it says. The second reason that
both try.
Thank you. The second reason that Brody versus Long, would, I better move on to the second reason.
Good idea. All right, go ahead.
Is that there is a statutory rule of construction. And so you cannot, we do not believe there's any authority to say that a rule of interpretation would trump a statutory rule of construction. The third reason Brody versus Long does not qualify or affect us is, if you look at Brody versus Long very closely, and there's only one sentence in there that that talks about this governmental entity preference, it cites Thompson's Real Estate. And both Brody versus Long and Thompson Real Estate, and indeed the entire section of Thompson's, is dealing with a legal description, an ambiguous legal description. As this court knows, there's an entire separate body of law dealing with ambiguous legal descriptions, and we are not dealing with an ambiguous legal description here. And then finally, the fourth point, Justice Crooks, would be that we, if Brody would apply, it is simply one of the mix of rules of interpretation that would attach here. And we have several other strong rules of interpretation involving easements, the first being that the law favors that an easement be appurtenant as opposed to being merely engrossed or personal. And then there is the strong law that favors the preservation of property rights and that easements are never forfeited unless necessary. Turning back then to the express reservation or the lack of an express reservation in the easement itself, it certainly would have been easy for the draftor to say, rather than to the grantee and not his heirs and assigns. Or it would have been easy to say to the grantee for as long as he owns the property. Or it would have been, as we do with timber deeds, easy to say to the grantee for 3 years or to the grantee for 5 years. There was a lot more direct path to expressly reserve this transferability right if that was the intention. And again, this is a drafter who put in four express reservations into the deed. The second triggering mechanism is the exception to the general rule of the statute is unless a different intent shall appear by necessary implication in the terms of such conveyance. And the statute requires that the terms of the conveyance create by necessary implication the reversal of the general rule that all rights conveyed are transferable. The statute does not say the general rule is reversed if the terms of the conveyance create a possible implication that the rule of transferability is reversed. It does not say that if there is a plausible implication that the rule of transferability is reversed. It does not even say that if the most probable implication is that the rule of transferability is reversed. It says only if by necessary implication will the rule of transferability be reversed.
May I ask a question on that? There was a $500 payment many years, more than 30 years ago. What is the economic value of the sand now?
Boy, that again, that's something that is not in the record, Justice Prosser, so I can't put a number on that. It has a value. It's obviously important to the operation, and it's tied to the flowage rights to allow you to exercise the flowage rights, but that's about all I can tell you. What I would caution is that we don't want to go back and second-guess the legislative decision made by the county in 1977 because there could have been a lot that went into that decision. Number one, the land value is very different back in 1977 for sandy, wet soil in Jackson County than it is now. Number two, it's hard to imagine now, but back then, the cranberry industry was in its embryonic stages, and certainly a legislative determination or intent could have been that we are going to encourage the establishment of this economic boon to our area.
Council, you mentioned intent, and it seems to me unusual that a permanent surrender of a public resource to a private entity may be found absent clear
and specific words to that effect. Can you respond to that?
I can, and I agree. And I think that there are clear and specific words in the easement. Once we apply the statute, this is where it's so important that one of two things, or actually both things, should happen. If you take paragraph 4 and read it in and of itself, there is no doubt that those sand rights are conveyable and that there is no express reservation in them. Well,
that's my question, is kind of the flip of what you're arguing. That is, you're saying there's no express reservation. And I'm saying it seems to me unusual that if it's a permanent relinquishment of a public resource, that that should be found with clear and specific words, or in the negative, it may be found only if there's clear and specific words to that effect. You know? But you're arguing that if they wanted to limit it, that would be clear and specific and express words. And I'm saying, boy, if they wanted to give a permanent surrender of a public resource to a private entity, I would expect some clear and specific words to that effect.
And if we apply the statute, Justice Bradley, then we do have the clear and specific words, because the statute says every conveyance shall pass all of the estate or interest. So that's where we start. And then the statute says, unless there's an express reservation or a necessary implication. So if we read paragraph 4 under the statute, it clearly conveys the interest.
Paragraph 4 conveys a right for the use of sand, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And this lawsuit is, in my opinion, what else it does beyond that.
Okay. All right. And again, we have to rely on the statute and the legislative direction saying that words of inheritance are not necessary. Okay.
Yeah. The fact that they're not necessary, in some ways, enters, may be relevant or may not be relevant. What's most important to me is what do these words say? That's what's most important to me. Because the fact that they used them one place and didn't use them the another place, I wonder why. Why did they do that? Did they do that because they knew they didn't have to use them any place, because the statute says they don't have to use them any place? Normally, when we're doing statutory construction, you give great moment to the fact that they used it in one sentence but didn't use it in another. That was an intentional difference. Maybe not. Could be inadvertence. But generally, I look at it as, they know what they're doing. It's just that it may not be totally clear.
And I understand, and I think that's why it's important then to look at the entire document. Because the only way that you can come up with this disagreement is to take the second and the fourth paragraph, compare and contrast them against each other, but then ignore the rest of the document. Because the very first paragraph, this easement, does not say heirs and assigns. It simply says to the grantee. So it would be illogical to say, well, the entire document is not transferable, but a part of it is. That seems like the reverse of logic, that you would go about it the other way, that you would reserve something, and that's what the statute says. You'd reserve something expressly if you didn't intend for the entire if you intended not for a clause within the document not to follow the entire document. I agree that it's important which words they chose. In fact, I agree that it's important that in the fourth paragraph, the drafter chose the word grantee, just as he did in the first paragraph. Now, I don't know why he chose Carl Nimitz and his heirs and assigns in the second paragraph. None of us know that. That's not in the record. But if we are assigning significance to the words that the drafter is choosing, which we should, then you cannot ignore the fact that he chose grantee in the fourth paragraph, and that is not what he chose in the second paragraph, thus taking the rug out from under the entire argument that, look, there's two parallel grants here, and they're exactly the same, except one contains errors and assigns, and one doesn't, because they are not exactly the same.
Counsel, there's been some discussion about the consideration, the $500 paid, and is there anything in the record to indicate what else the county has gotten as a result of the benefit of its bargain from 30 years ago in the form of property taxes or any other economic benefit the county derived?
Right. There really is nothing in the record, Your Honor, because of the way this case came up as far as just what you said, economic benefits from taxes. The only thing in the record, quite honestly, is the reservation of rights for hunting and fishing rights, which is interesting in the sense that as you overflow the land with water, you lose some hunting rights, but you gain some fishing rights.
There's also been some discussion about the permanent nature of this easement, but I think it was part and parcel of it. It's permanent so long as the land is being used for cranberry growth.
That's exactly what we would say, Your Honor. And
well, that's exactly what the easement says.
Right, right.
You know, the warranty deed from Nemitz to the Borax conveys to the grantees, their heirs and assigns, all their rights for the flowage and sand rights. Now, they opposing counsel said, of course, they can't deed out what they don't have. But it seems to me that that language indicates they thought they could deed out the sand rights.
We agree. It's clear they wouldn't have deeded them, especially given the fact it was so close in time to when they received them. They wouldn't have deeded them if they didn't believe that they could transfer them. I think it is also significant that the county, within a year of when they signed the original easement, signed a correction deed, correction easement, again, granting the sand rights.
Is this language, other than the description, is this language of the easement the exact same as in the earlier document?
Yes.
Yes, just the description.
Year ahead of time.
Correct.
And then he gets that easement, and a year later, Nemitz deeds this land out and deeds it with the easements.
That's correct.
Both sand and flowage. So he thought he had them.
Yeah, Nemitz clearly thought he had them.
Does the record indicate how much sand is removed?
It does not indicate how much sand is available to be removed. It's there's certain types of sand that can be used and certain types of sand that aren't, and there's just nothing in the record to indicate what's there right now.
Does the record indicate how the sand is removed?
It doesn't, but you would typically excavate it out to remove the sand, and then it has to be used on the cranberry beds for a cranberry culture.
I'm trying to get a picture in my mind. Are there dump trucks or something that go in? And
I think that's exactly right. There's some sort of excavation equipment that would come in, obviously, before the water overflows the property. Once the water has overflowed the property, then you would have to drain the reservoir to get at the sand. I guess you still could get at it.
Okay. You talked about the essential importance of the flowage rights. Is the sand also essential to this whole process?
Oh, yes. Yes, the sand is an essential part of the process.
So let's say a cranberry bog owner somewhere else didn't have sand rights. Would they have to go out and buy the sand and bring it in?
Correct. They'd have to find a suitable sand and then purchase it and truck it in.
And they cover the entire bog, do they? Or how do they do this?
Sand basically gets used three ways in a cranberry operation. The first is when the ice is over the bogs, they spread sand out over the ice so that when the ice melts, it adds sand to the bottom of the bog, thereby keeping the height of the plants at a harvestable height. That's as detailed as I can give you, Justice Prosser, but that's the intent. The other way that sand is used is to the dikes and the roads and such have to be shored up, and the sand is put along those to help hold those in place.
Council, did the same person draft the easement for flowage rights that's at, it's labeled Exhibit B, it's Appendix 103, as the warranty deed, which is Exhibit A, Appendix 102?
They did not. Mr. Hazelbaker has pointed out in his briefs they were both ex-Jackson County Circuit Court judges. I believe what happened is Justice Radcliffe drafted the first one. He was then became okay. The judge, and Justice Lobbs drafted the second one.
But the first one, which one do you consider the first one? The warranty deed is dated May 8, 78, and the easement is dated May 12, 78. So which one's the first one?
That's a good point. I guess I was saying the first one because in my mind I'm taking the easement back to 1977.
Because presumably when they did the easement for flowage rights, they knew that this warranty deed had been filed 4 days previous that granted flowage and sand rights. No?
I agree, because typically when you have a correction deed, it comes up in that there's a second transaction and they discover there's an error with the description, so they go back and fix it. So certainly it would have been... I shouldn't say certainly, but as you said, presumably they knew that this deed was transferring the property to the Borics.
So Gerald Lobbs drafted the warranty deed from May 8, 78, and who drafted the...
Robert Radcliffe.
Okay. From but 4 days later, or filed 4 days later?
Looks like that, yeah. The deeds are, the dates are confusing.
Is that filed, I can't tell, is that May 10? Even though it's dated May 8th? Or is that May 18? Can you tell in your draft? It just seems to me, I mean, part of the conflict for me is you have a warranty deed that concerns flowage rights and sand rights and transfers that. And then after that is filed, you have this corrective easement that we're trying to interpret today.
True, and I think that there's no significance to that being after the deed other than the possible intent significance, because the exact wording in the 1970 or the deed in 1977, the easement flowage, is the same wording as the correction deed, which is the one that we're interpreting today.
I don't want to take up your time, your red light's on, so thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Hazelbaker.
Thank you, Justice Abrams and members. And I want to tell you that we've had a very collegial and cooperative relationship in this case, for which I appreciate the help of Mr. Arndt. I'd like to address Justice Gableman's point about the value to the county of the economic benefit of the farm development here, the cranberry bog. I'd point out that under Section 70.32, subparagraph 2R, unparent, this
70,
is tax... 70.32, subparent 2, small letter R, unparent. This, as is the case with all agricultural land, is taxed at its use value, so it just doesn't generate significant property taxes. Of course, it is an economic enterprise, but it wouldn't have been done for that reason. The real issue here, members of the court, is
Mr.
that...
Mr. Hazelbaker, that didn't happen until about 20 years later.
It happened in 1996, that's true. However, farmland didn't generate a huge amount of assessments, and certainly boggy farmland didn't generate a huge amount of property tax assessments even in the 1970s. The whole point that is at issue here is which of these two analyses, which of these two competing inferences, which is how I describe how an unambiguous deed is subject to argument, which of these two analyses is proper. I could only say this, that for Borick's position to carry the day, a number of things have to happen. First of all, you have to ignore the words heirs and assigns in the operative paragraph and instead assume that, as the Court of Appeals did, the drafter of the deed put it in one place but didn't put it in any other out of either sloppiness or, as they called it, some kind of archaic tradition. I don't think we can attribute incompetence to a drafter like that. We also have to assume that the words right and privilege in connection with the sand rights refer to or are meant to be an easement. The document uses the term easement in several places, but in the operative paragraph about the sand rights, it characterizes those rights as the further right and privilege to remove sand. Now, again, everything in this case is about words, and if it had been intended that the right to remove sand be an easement, it would have been easy for the drafter to say that. Now, Mr. Arndt has argued ably in his brief that a right and privilege is an easement. That may be true by interpreting precedent. But why go there when the express language chosen by the drafter and signed off by the grantor and grantee does not?
Counsel, my question to opposing counsel, which I asked you, was in regard to any known economic benefit to the county in addition to the $500 initial consideration. Are you aware of whether the record reflects any other additional economic benefit to the county as a result of this?
The record doesn't. I think one would assume that the parties entered into this transaction for mutual benefit, though. I don't think that's disputable. It further becomes necessary to sustain Borick's position to do what Justice Bradley said, which is assume by inference that this grant of sand rights was intended to allow a private property owner the indefinite right to mine a county forest. And that's simply not a plausible agreement. I appreciate
that. But it gives them the indefinite right to flood.
Well, that's the indefinite right to flood private land where it's of benefit to the cranberry bog. That's not enough. That doesn't impact public rights at all.
I thought that the cranberry bog had the right to, the right of the marsh to overflow Jackson County land. That's the way it was described.
Well, they can
us.
Move land. They move water through, but ultimately they get water from the county and they give it to the county.
Okay, but they're going to flood at one point or other.
Well, it's a flowage right that allows them to have a cranberry bog. The county. The Brody rule, which came up very briefly in argument, I think is significant. First of all, I go back to the point that it is a rule that matters because there are competing inferences here. We've said in argument, there have been references in argument a number of times that this is one of those cases where, you know, you could make strong arguments back and forth. If Brody tells us anything, it's that ties go to the runner being the government in this case. I think the significance of public lands is, as Justice Bradley said, that it's important that we safeguard public lands and that we not lightly impute to the parties an intent to allow people to mine county forest land indefinitely. Words mean everything. If that was what was intended, it would have been done. Thank you very much for your attention, members of the court.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Hazeldecker, and thank you, Mr. Arndt. Learned more about cranberry marshes than I knew. I'm not sure what all this language means, but that's the point of this case. So thank you both, and that terminates the argument in 08 AP 1144, Borick Cranberry Marsh versus Jackson County. We are supposed to be having additional students come in. Are they here? The court will take a short recess to allow our students' groups to come in. Thank you.